Straps and holes, party and ring. Spin let loose, but wearing thin. Biting through the shifting power leans to you, and the card is on the wheel. Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for Wednesday morning call-in radio here on Kibu Community Radio, where the time is 23 minutes before 8 o'clock, and the number to call to join in the conversation this morning is 503-231-8187. Well, I'm back from Venezuela, well, barely back. It's been an interesting culture shock to return to this country. That is referred to, this was referred to by many of the activists that I met at the World Social Forum, where I was attending in Caracas, at the belly of the beast, a phrase actually that I hadn't heard that much in a really long time. So this morning I want to talk some about the World Social Forum, or Foro Social Mundo, as it's called in Latin America, and also some about just my impressions about being in Venezuela and being able to see the Bolivarian Revolution firsthand. And this is actually probably pretty much a cursory discussion this morning, because I'm hoping next week to have Patrick Engstrom-Porer on with me, who was kind of our host there in Venezuela. He has been working on a radio project in Latin America since September, and he arrived in Venezuela, I think, late December, actually, or mid-December, and he pretty much made a lot of arrangements for several of us to come down and meet him and work with him and hang out with him, and it was a wonderful combination of interesting working trip as well as having an incredible time exploring the natural wonders of Venezuela as well. So Patrick's hopefully going to be on next week, as well as a couple of the people I wind up traveling with, and we'll, I'm hoping, have a lively discussion about our impressions. But it was a very exciting place to be, and also a very interesting time to be down in Venezuela, as the rhetoric, the hostile rhetoric between the United States and Venezuela really was escalating while we were there. And it was interesting to see the contradiction between what Donald Rumsfeld was depicting in his remarks last week when he referred to Chavez, or compared Chavez to Hitler, to compare those remarks with what I was actually seeing in Venezuela. A lot of why I wanted to go there was to see for real, you know, what this government of Hugo Chavez is about, and to see if it's as great as it sounds in left-wing articles that you read in the United States, and to see what was really happening with the people in the community, see what kind of support he had, and hopefully to hear him speak and, you know, get a sense from that, you know, because I've seen him in movies, on television, I've heard him speak on the radio, but to actually see him in person, I thought might give me a better sense of who he is. And we did have an opportunity to hear him speak about 2 weeks ago. He addressed a very large gathering at the forum, and actually it was pretty much like seeing him on television, because this hall was so huge and we were sitting way, way up in the balcony, so I spent more time actually watching the TV screen than I did watching him. But that definitely was very different from just like watching it actually on television, because of the electricity that he is able to generate in person when he's speaking. And I came out actually quite impressed with him, and found that there seems to be some very solid, serious support for him. I also met people who despise his government and who think that things are worse now than ever before. And as Patrick, who was on the show a few weeks ago, was describing, when he was at that point living in Valencia, which is about 2.5 hours west of Caracas, and an industrial city close to the coast. And at that point in Patrick's stay in Venezuela, all he'd met so far were rich people, and so he just met everybody who hated Chavez. Then when he moved to Caracas, it was a very different story, and the support for Chavez in Caracas is very, very deep, though of course it depends on what part of Caracas you're in. And so that was sort of my experience, too, that when we were in poorer neighborhoods, and of course at the forum, and there were a lot of Venezuelans at the forum, but of course they're all progressives. But at one point we also were able to do a tour of one of the barrios, in Caracas, and the support for Chavez was really deep there. But just my anecdotal impressions from walking around the streets and having people just call out things to us. One night we were going back to our hotel after the forum, and this guy was just getting into his car in front of our hotel, which is in a pretty working class part of the city. And this guy looked like he was probably a chauffeur or something, and he calls out to us, "In the name of Chavez, I welcome you to Venezuela." And it was very funny because part of what was going on for us is we were trying to find out when Chavez was going to be speaking. And I think this was probably on Wednesday night. And I arrived on Tuesday morning, and then we heard these rumors. I mean, I had read an article actually online that he was going to be speaking on Friday. And, or no, I think he was supposed to be speaking on Thursday. That was the original rumor. And the World Social Forum, actually, if you want to get a really good description of the World Social Forum, I recommend going to truthat.org, one of my favorite websites. And in the center of the front page, there's a, well, I think it said A Week in Venezuela. And you can click on that, and there's some very interesting blogs and essays about the World Social Forum, including a pretty interesting one from Cindy Sheehan, who was there and who spoke at one point. Actually, she spoke at several points. So, but the World Social Forum was incredibly disorganized and chaotic, and it was very hard to find out anything. And so you would think that when the president of the host nation is going to be giving an address, that this would be publicized in advance, and it would be all over the place, and everybody would know. So we were spending, from the first day we got there, we were trying to figure out, when is Chavez going to be speaking? So when we hear this guy say something about Chavez, Patrick, whose Spanish was the best of all of ours there at the time, jumped to the conclusion that the guy was saying something about the fact that Chavez was going to be speaking. And so we're trying to figure this out. And finally, we realized that he's saying, "In the name of Chavez, I welcome you to Venezuela." And it was just this wonderful moment that we almost totally blew because we were trying to make some practical sense out of it. But he was one of many people who made comments like that, and just kind of out of the blue. And also the last day that I was in Venezuela, there was a big march in Caracas. And I was at that point in a community called Merida. Actually, I was at the Merida airport about to fly back to Caracas. So I was watching this big march and rally on television while I was waiting for my plane. And it looked like there were hundreds of thousands of people in the street. And it was just this big support for Chavez. And it was in memory of the failed coup that Chavez led in 1992. And I had this mixed feeling watching this because on the one hand, it was really heartening to see these throngs of people out supporting the Bolivarian Revolution. On the other hand, the way that the flag waving was going on, the way that also this was the state-run TV we were watching this on. And so they had sort of the same shots over and over again. And there was this bit that I just felt like it looked a little bit like propaganda and reminded me some of rallies in Cuba where there is certainly a personality cult around Fidel in Cuba. And that's one of the things that I was really wanting to check out was how much of a personality cult is going on around Chavez. And if there's other people waiting to continue the work of this revolution, or if it's so totally dependent on this one man, Chavez, who is seen by his opponents as just doing a power grab and changing the Constitution so he can be the president for life. And again, if you want to join the conversation this morning, I'm talking right now about the World Social Forum and my experiences in Venezuela over the last 2 weeks. You can give a call at 503-231-8187. And just kind of a preview of another thing I want to touch on today and hope to go more in depth in coming weeks is a discussion about this research project at Oregon State University about the impacts of logging in burned areas, particularly in the biscuit burn. And this report was published in Science magazine a few weeks ago, and it's really touched off, pardon my pun, a firestorm of concern and opposition amongst the School of Forestry at Oregon State University, which is closely tied to the timber industry and actually gets a lot of funding from the timber industry. And in fact, John Sessions, the really pro-logging professor at OSU, led an effort to try to prevent the paper from being published in Science. And as an upshot of all of this, the BLM, Bureau of Land Management, which was funding a three-year research project, just cut off funding for the last year of this project. So that's something else I want to talk about a little bit later on today. But in the meantime, I want to continue talking about Venezuela and would be very happy to talk with any of you. In fact, if any of you were there at the World Social Forum, because it seemed like half of Portland was there. In fact, I saw more people from Portland and Caracas than I have seen when I go to marches in Washington or San Francisco. So it was really amazing to see such a large Portland turnout. And in fact, the first day I was there, I kind of just been flying all night, and I was functioning about 2 hours of sleep. And I go to a big march and rally in Caracas and run into the PCAS delegation, which was there about 24 strong, I think, 25 people. And there's all these people I know from Portland. So that was a very interesting way to start out this whole thing. So again, if you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-318-1187. It's about 14 and a half minutes before 8 o'clock here on KBOO Community Radio. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to say that if your impression that there's a personality cult around Mr. Chavez, that's not a negative, especially if it brings to the Venezuelan people what the personality cult around Castro brought to the people of Cuba. And I'd like to say that it's very obvious that you're pulling a sneak attack on Chavez. Thank you.
Do you want to, are you getting off the air? Do you want to engage in any kind of discussion? I guess he's off the air. Well, I don't think I'm doing a sneak attack on Chavez, because the way that I really evaluate Chavez is the work that he's doing, and more than the words that he says, which his words are quite inspiring. But going into the barrios, which I was only there for a few hours, so I would hardly say that I got an in-depth look at what's going on, but we did get a tour, and it was kind of an ad hoc tour. This guy who basically is one of the community leaders in this barrio, which is Vente Tres de Dinero, the 23rd of January barrio, in celebration of an uprising back in 1958 against the then dictator of Venezuela. And this is the most organized of all the barrios, and kind of the model barrio. But we were taken around and saw the healthcare centers, saw the community radio station, stopped people on the street who were neighborhood activists, and who just, you know, was one guy was riding his motorcycle down the street, and our tour leader stopped him, and the guy started talking. He was a president of one of the neighborhood associations there, and just kind of gave his impressions. And so we're seeing exactly like the advances that are being made in education and healthcare and housing. These people were talking about how before Chavez they barely had water or electricity, and now they actually have a natural gas pipeline that's going through a good part of this community. And you can really see that there are definite real things happening. And then there's also a spirit. I mean, I think the core, and one person said this, that the key to what's going on in Venezuela is the new constitution. And not only is this new constitution, for the large part, a very egalitarian, very democratic, and very forward-looking document, but it's also being put into practice. People know the constitution. They sell it at every street corner. In fact, I brought home a CD-ROM with it in English, which I'm about to read. And the people apply the Constitution in the everyday work, and in their political work, and in their personal work. And I think it's something, I don't know how many Americans could really recite the United States Constitution to you, but the Venezuelans are very proud of their Constitution and really embodying it. So these are the parts of Chavez's work that I have a great deal of respect for and I really believe in. But I think that the question about the personality cult issue, which a lot of us talked about, and I think all of us came there wanting to support Chavez's government, but we also want to do it critically and intelligently, and not just, you know, with flag waving and lip syncing to things. But to really, you know, want to, if we're supporting this revolution, we really understand all of its warts and crevices. And in fact, Chavez will admit the things that are difficult, the things that are not going fast enough, the things that really need to change. And they refer to this whole thing as the process, that it's a process that they're in, and they haven't, that the process is going to go on for a long time. It's a whole transformation of a society. And the question that I raise is that Chavez is accused by his opponents of trying to make this grab for power and changing the Constitution so that he can remain president for a very, very long time. And I've got contradictory, kept asking people, well, how long, according to the Constitution, can Chavez be president? And one answer was till 2012, another answer was till 2021. I'm not sure if that had to do with dyslexia or which one is actually accurate. But if in fact, Chavez can be president for another 15 years, that seems like a really long time for one person to be at the helm of a country. And I think that's, in fact, one of the problems with Cuba, that I think if in a real democracy, that there is room for more than one leader, and that, you know, leadership can change, and that it's also something where it should be, the leadership should be elected. And one of my friends I was traveling with said, well, Fidel is elected every election. They have elections in Cuba. She said he wins by such a large margin that everybody, all his opponents just kind of get sifted out very early in the electoral process by the way that the Cuban elections run. Well, it also could be said the Cuban elections are set up in such a way that Fidel is guaranteed he'll continue to be the leader. It's not exactly the same in Venezuela. It seems like the democratic process is a bit more transparent. In fact, it was quite approved by Jimmy Carter's commission in the last elections. But it would be nice. It seems to me that there are some very strong leaders around Chavez. He's not the only person. He's not the only person with a vision there. He's not the only person with the energy. But he has that kind of amazing charisma, like Fidel has, to really bring people together and to get people behind him. And I'm not sure there's anybody else that has that charisma right now. So while I don't think that I'm seeing at the moment that Chavez is leading a demagogic kind of government and that he's going to be a one-man rule for the rest of his life, I just think it's a very important question to keep asking and to help keep the Venezuelan revolution honest, because I think the things that are happening there are really inspiring for the rest of the people in Latin America and around the world, and that was something that really came across at the World Social Forum. So again, if you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 8 minutes before 8 o'clock. I think we have a phone call. So hello, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question which may sound a little bit flippant, so please bear with me. Do you happen to know anything about immigrating to Venezuela?
Actually, I don't. I think a lot of us were fantasizing about it because I kind of had some mixed feelings about being in Venezuela. I mean, I first of all, we were talking a lot about the whole thing about being an expatriate and whether Americans belong in Venezuela or whether we should be staying here and trying to make changes, you know, really create significant social change in this country, which is pretty much how I believe. I think it's a very valuable thing to go to other countries and see what's happening there, but to go live there when things... The world is really not going to change unless the United States has changed from within, and that's something I came back feeling very strongly. So I do feel like our role is here. But I'll tell you, it's very tempting in many ways to think about immigrating to Venezuela because of the excitement of what's happening politically, and it is a beautiful country. I mean, Caracas was not, I thought was kind of a miserable city itself, and I wouldn't really want to spend a lot of time there. But the rest of the country is just incredibly beautiful, and the people are wonderful, and there's an awful lot of both, you know, on the political and social and cultural. The music is incredible. And then we were up in the Andes for a week, and I've never seen mountains like the Andes. They are, it was quite a place to be.
Okay, well, I was just kind of curious because I have to say that I've been considering immigrating away from the States. In fact, I spent the first, two or three years in my 20s looking for another country, to be quite honest with you. And now with Chavez, that pull has gotten stronger to see such progressive leadership being accepted by the masses is just wonderful.
But I would say if you were seriously thinking about emigrating to a country like Venezuela, I think you need to really consider what you have to offer that country. Mm-hmm. And there's one of the big lessons is just, when you're around that much poverty, and Venezuela has a lot more wealth than a lot of other countries in Latin America, and in fact that's what's kind of startling. When you go to Caracas, if you're on the east side of Caracas, you might as well be in a very ritzy section of LA. It looks a lot like LA, except the high rises are like New York. But in fact, I felt like it was this weird combination of New York and LA. And when you're in the poorer sections, it feels more like being in South Central or East LA or Spanish Harlem. I mean, and that was what was very odd. I felt like I was still in a North American city, only I was in the Latino community of a North American city, because there's so much multinational presence in Caracas, and everything that you see in the street corners in LA, in terms of multinational franchises, you're going to see in the street corners of Caracas. Then you get up in the barrios, which are up in the hillside, and there's something that I don't think you see in the United States on that level of poverty. So you start to really see this real disparity between rich and poor. And I've never been in a city where it's so apparent as it is in Caracas.
Wow.
So I think that that's a big lesson, and to think about what are you going to bring to an area where there is so much poverty, where there is still so much inequity, and where there's so much need. And, I mean, what's interesting to me is, as a radio person, there's a lot of work going on in community radio. And, in fact, my friend Patrick is down there working on that right now. And community radio is certainly a very important element in Venezuela culture, because aside from the state-owned media and now a handful of alternative media, most of the media in Venezuela is owned by very rich conservative people who are kind of like run stations kind of like Fox News. And it's very like just this ongoing 24-hour anti-government propaganda. And the private media played a big role in the 2002 attempted coup against Chavez. So that's one area where Venezuela really can use some help, is some strong independent media. It's not the state-owned media, but certainly not the private media as well. But I think any time you're going to go to a country in the developing world, you really need to think about, well, what can I bring here, or am I just kind of going as a tourist or to escape from a place that I feel bad about?
Interesting. Well, thank you. I appreciate your time.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling. And the number to call this morning is 503-231-8187, just as it is every morning here on KBOO, and you are listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. And I'm talking this morning about sort of the surface view of my experiences in Venezuela over the last couple of weeks. And I haven't talked much about the World Social Forum, so I think that'd be something that'd be very interesting to get into as well and talk a little bit more about some of the things that happened there. And if you want to join the conversation, particularly I'm interested in anybody who was down in Caracas at the World Social Forum, or people who have firsthand experience with Venezuela, give a call at 503-231-8187. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I was wondering, is there anything negative about the Chavez regime that you found? If you could elaborate on any of it, because I'm sure it's not all good with this guy.
Okay, well, I'll tell you some of the things that... Are you still there? Or are you getting off the air? Okay, well, anyway. Let's say the first negative experience that anybody who flies into Caracas has is that it takes... the Caracas airport used to be about a half hour by a very... good road called the Autopista, which is basically a freeway from downtown Caracas. The airport is on the coast in an area called Macatia, and Caracas is over one ring of mountains away from the coast. And so there's this high-speed highway, and it was easy trip in, and you know, not any further than getting from like the LA airport into downtown LA, and probably less traffic and took less time. But part of this road is this engineering feat. It's a viaduct that goes across this incredible canyon. And an amazing engineering feat. It was built, I guess, in the 1950s. And unfortunately, was not quite as good an engineering feat as they had hoped, because the area where the supports on either side of the viaduct are in a very slide-prone area in the mountains, and it's been excessive rains on the coast all winter, and the support started giving away, and so the viaduct started to buckle, and now it's closed. So now, in order to get from the airport into Caracas, it's anywhere from an hour and a half to a four-hour trip on these very windy mountain roads, very, very congested. They've done a thing in order to deal with this where they have to truck traffic during the day, and then at night only trucks can be on the road. So if you fly into the airport at night, and most flights are scheduled from the United States to arrive at the airport between like 10:30 and 11 at night, you basically have to spend the night out at the coast and then come in the next day. My flight actually fortunately got changed, and so I flew in at 6:15 in the morning, so I didn't have to spend the night out there, because a lot of people have been winding up spending the night in the airport. Well, Chavez's opponents claim that this is an example of the corruption and ineptitude of his government, that this is something that they've known for years, and in fact they've known for at least 10 years that there was some problems with the structure and that it needed to be replaced, basically. And there's a lot of criticism that Chavez didn't move fast enough on this, and that some people are, you know, were arguing he's so busy giving oil to heating oil to the Bronx and Boston, and giving money to Bolivia, that he's not supporting his own people. And I wouldn't argue. I mean, I wouldn't hold up with that argument. But I do feel that there probably there were some problems in his government, and the person who was in charge, the Department of Ministry, who actually oversaw the infrastructure, has been criticized by people in the government. Well, ultimately, that comes down to Chavez and his government himself, and he should be the one ultimately responsible for overseeing all of his appointees. So that's the first thing that you realize. There's some really serious problems with the infrastructure of this country, and it's getting worse, and there's some questions about whether Chavez is really dealing with it in the best way. So that I thought, is a good question to be raised. I, again, keep raising this question of how long he intends to be president, and that makes me uncomfortable, because I would like to see somebody else in the wings who would be ready to run in a democratic process, who would succeed Chavez after his next term. I think the terms are 5 years. And so I have no problem with Chavez running again. I mean, he's actually, with the change in the Constitution and the way things ran, he's actually going to have been president for, I guess, about 12 years altogether, because there were 2 years he was president before the Constitution was instituted. But it always makes me nervous when there's one person who seems to think that he's the only person who can really, you know, make the changes that are necessary. And I keep thinking about Nelson Mandela, who was president for a while after the liberation of South Africa, and then stepped aside and let somebody else be president. And maybe his successor does not measure up to Nelson Mandela, but I think it shows a lot that Nelson Mandela got it, that it wasn't about him, it's about the people of South Africa. And while Chavez will give lip service to that it's not about him, it's about the people of Venezuela, it does seem like it's still right now an awful lot about him as well. So those are a couple of the concerns that I have. Then the other side, that can be argued that they haven't made nearly as much progress economically or in terms of a lot of the projects they've started as they would hope. And it can be said that a good part of that reason has to do with all the attacks coming from the United States, which fund internal attacks. But there was the strike, the oil industry strike in 2002. Between 2002 and 2003, after the attempted coup. The attempted coup, of course, was certainly, you know, a setback for the government and was a real distraction from the work that they were trying to do. There have been all kinds of attacks. You know, there was the attempt to recall Chavez, which was voted down very, very strongly, and that was in 2004. So up until 2004, basically, Chavez was a government under attack by the United States. Now the attacks from the United States are much more covert, though they're still definitely going on. But I think Chavez feels like there's more breathing room to really start expanding on his programs, which are called missions. And there's a mission for each different concern of the country: education mission, the health mission, the housing mission, and several others. They're doing kind of following in the footsteps of Cuba with a very strong literacy program, as well as having a lot of Cuban doctors who are training Venezuelans to run these medical clinics in the barrios. And I need to let you know that you are listening to KBOL Portland, listener-sponsored community radio at 90.7 in the Portland metro area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, 100.7 in the Mid-Willamette Valley. It's about 4 minutes after 8 o'clock here on Locus Focus. Good morning, you're on the air.
Yeah, well, I'm curious about this country, about do they grow hemp or medical marijuana for pain and or the medical marijuana, that is, for pain or medical problems, or do they use a lot of medications and surgery for their health problems? I don't know if anybody was able to find out about that.
Well, I actually didn't do a whole lot of in-depth study into what they're doing,
okay.
But I was actually in a clinic. I mean, I don't think that they're growing. I don't think that marijuana is legal in Venezuela, and I didn't hear a whole lot about medical marijuana.
Uh-huh.
Marijuana is definitely available there. But I think that...
Do they put people in prison if they use it or smoke it?
They have to catch you first. But, I mean, I could tell a story, but I wouldn't tell it on the air.
Oh, okay.
But anyway...
Thank you.
But I'll tell it to friends off the air later, because actually it was a very interesting... This is also gets me to another... another experience. I mean, there's a lot of soldiers in Venezuela. The military's presence is very strong, especially on that windy, torturous road from the airport to Caracas. In fact, Patrick said to me, you'll feel very secure because the military is everywhere, because there were a lot of concerns about the road being dangerous and there being bandits on the road. And I never saw so much military presence, except at marches on Washington, as I saw on that road. And you see military people, you know, throughout Caracas. They were throughout Merida. They're basically military police, and they're dressed in camouflage. And they're smiling, and they are very friendly, and they seem very non-threatening. And even the ones who have weapons don't seem to be particularly threatening. I felt much more threatened after September 11th when I flew into the Baltimore-Washington airport and was greeted by National Guardsmen with fixed bayonets pointed at ready as we got off the plane. So I would say that the military presence, what people have said, and this is something, you know, that I would need to spend more time to know if it's really true, it's really different when you feel like the military are on your side. The military are there in our fantasy to protect the people, and they're kind of... There's also police, and we saw some police in Caracas, and actually less police presence, it seemed, in Merida, and more of these military police. But my strongest image of the difference between the military in Venezuela and the military, let's say, in the United States, one of the events for the World Social Forum was at this little airport called Carlotta Airport, which is kind of a military airport on the outskirts of Caracas. And so we're walking into the airport, and you have to be searched when you go into it, but it's kind of a pretty minor search. And then we were walking through the area to where the tents and the stages were for the events we're going to go to. And there were a couple military police standing as we walked past, and they were holding paper airplanes, and they were kind of playing with these paper airplanes as we walked past them. And I thought that seemed to be kind of sweet, and certainly a very different image. I can't imagine if you walked into an Air Force base in the United States, the guards there would be playing with paper airplanes. And that, in a way, it seemed to sort of be metaphorical for the feeling, the very playfulness of the villain culture, and sort of the sense, maybe I'm just romanticizing it, but it did seem to be a little bit of the sense of the Bolivarian Revolution, that that this is where, you know, the military really are kind of playful now, and they're there to support people. In fact, during the attempted coup in 2002, it turned out that there were only a few higher-ups, a few of the brass, that supported the coup, and the rank and file didn't, and that's why the coup failed, because these soldiers, who many of them come from very poor backgrounds themselves and felt that they were benefiting from Chavez's government, supported Chavez and turned the coup around. Well, if you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 8 minutes after 8 o'clock here on KIBU. And we're talking this morning about the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela, my brief experiences there over the last couple of weeks. And also I want to talk a little bit about the World Social Forum, or Foro Social Mundo. Besides being very chaotic, there were some very amazing events. I mean, just on the downside of it is that most of the events we found out after they happened, because the communication just didn't exist. There was a program that came out twice, this big program that was very hard to find. In fact, we only found it at the alternative media centers where we would be spending a lot of time. It wasn't something that the common forum participants actually had much access to. And this schedule, they didn't have like any kind of simple grid where it was by location and by time or by subject. And the forum was spread out all over Caracas, which I think the idea was that people wouldn't be isolated from the city, you know, off in some kind of conference area, as you often are when you go to a conference in a city. You never see the city. You're just doing your conference. So here, since you had to take the metro and the buses and walk and just kind of go all over the city, you really got a feel of Caracas. And that felt really fascinating. I really did see probably at least half of Caracas in the week that I was there, because we were just trucking everywhere. On the other hand, it was very hard to get to events, and you kind of, once you were at a place, you would tend to want to just stay there for a while instead of running all over the city for different events. And the events were not scheduled in any kind of logic, so it wasn't like all the cultural events in one place and the media events in another place and the agrarian events in another place, which would have maybe made a little bit more sense. And then there was another problem that at least seemed like about a third of the events didn't happen, and lots of us complained to each other that we'd go, you know, travel for a half hour to an event, and then it wasn't there, and then you go looking around for something else to do there and feel a little disappointed. But the events that I did go to were pretty amazing, and the two things that really struck me the strongest were two panels I went of Bolivian indigenous people who have now taken control of the government in Bolivia, and we're talking about the revolution in Bolivia. And the one panel, the first one, which was a very long, this theater, which is kind of at the center of this area in Caracas called Parque Central, and this was a big event. and translated. They had simultaneous translations. And there were several people from Bolivia, as well as a union oil, I think an oil industry union person from Brazil, and somebody from Venezuela. And the people from Bolivia were all indigenous people. And then on this other panel that I went to the next day, it was all Bolivian people kind of talking about the process of what they're going through and what their plans are, how they are shaping this revolution. And the big comparison, and this is interesting, is we see Venezuela, you know, sort of as the model of the new left society, but in reality, in Bolivia, they see Venezuela as a top-down revolution because it happened with Chavez. Chavez, who is not from the poorer classes and has a military background, gets elected and out of the goodness of his heart, you know, kind of decides to do good things for the people, which is not exactly true because actually there's been a lot of insurrection in the barrios in Caracas and other parts of Venezuela for many years. And Chavez was able to rise to power because there was a lot of strong social movements. But in Bolivia, Evo Morales is in fact the product of these very strong indigenous movements that have been going on for years, which have shut down the country and thrown out three governments. And so they talked about how Bolivia is really a bottom-up revolution, and it was very fascinating to hear about that. Anyway, if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 12 minutes after 8 o'clock here on Kibu Community Radio. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm driving through your air. I'm an actual red state resident, so some of this information that you're providing is obviously pretty new to me because the mainstream media doesn't carry very much of it. I'm wondering if you could, for just the sake of backing up and giving me a quick primer, if you could maybe, you know, give me a quick view from 20,000 feet, what a semi-disinterested party might see as the big conflict between the Venezuelan government and our current administration, you know, kind of the top one or two issues, and kind of what you saw while you were there.
Okay, well, actually, the top issue is oil, because Venezuela is the second largest oil supplier to the United States. I think
right.
Most of our oil from Mexico and Venezuela, which is claiming now to have the largest oil reserves in the world. I mean, I'm not sure if it's true, but they claim they have larger oil reserves than Saudi Arabia or Iraq. And so it's all about oil. Now, the second thing that it's about is who controls South Latin America. And for a long time, Latin America has really been controlled by the United States. And there are these indigenous, both literally speaking and figuratively speaking, movements popping up throughout Latin America, which are, and the two strongest ones are Venezuela and Bolivia now, but to a lesser degree in Argel and the new government in Chile, and there's movements afoot in Ecuador. And actually, the person who's running for president in Peru is starting to talk this independent streak rhetoric. But these countries are all starting to say Latin America for the Latin Americans, basically, that we are going to control our own destiny. We're going to control our own resources. We are no longer just, you know, a big strip mine for the United States' companies to come down and take all of our resources and all of our profits. And, I mean, a big turning point has been in Bolivia, battles over water in the city of Cochabamba, which where the water was privatized by, I believe, Bechtel, and the city revolted and threw out Bechtel and brought down the government as well over that issue. So I think it's about natural resources, and it's about who basically controls destiny of Latin Americans, whether it's Latin Americans or whether it continues to be North Americans.
Does the Venezuelan government seem to have a bent on not wanting to sell resources to the United States? I mean, it seems to me that as a moderate, as a general rule, what we're looking for is people who are willing to sell their products at a reasonable price in an open market, and, you know, whether they sell to China or wherever, shouldn't really seem to be a big problem.
Well, I think that the issue for Venezuela sees its oil as a very strong lever. And Venezuelan's oil is kind of like Iran or North Korea's nuclear programs. It's a way to be able to have some leverage against the United States hegemony.
In order to accomplish
autonomy. So I think the big issue for Venezuela is
okay.
That they want autonomy. They want to control their own destiny. And they also, and this is the big threat to the United States, they want to be an inspiration for other countries in Latin America and across the world, for people to rise up and to say, we are going to control our own resources. We are no longer just going to be a place for the United States to come in, take our resources, and just impoverish us. And that's a very simplistic way of saying that's what's going on around the world. But I think it's kind of an honest assessment of what's happening in Africa and parts of Asia, certainly throughout Latin America, and certainly in the Middle East now. So I think that Chavez would love to continue selling oil to the United States, but that he can use, he can withdraw the oil as a very strong stick as far as the foreign policy debate that's going on between Venezuela and the United States.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Okay. So thanks for calling.
Sure.
And any other questions?
Well, I am a I'm a financial advisor. I work in, you know, big capital markets in the United States. You know, so obviously I'm very aware of the profit motive and kind of believe in the coming of the global economy. You know, I kind of, you know, you listen, you're listening to me and trying to get a feel for where I stand and vice versa. And I just am kind of curious, what is it that Venezuela hopes to, I mean, I can see that American countries would want to go in and, quote-unquote, help Venezuela develop their natural resources. You can see that there's a natural tendency, if you're a large corporation with lots of technology and getting at things bigger, better, faster, cheaper, that you'd want, you know, the profit that you could gain from getting into that kind of a market. I could see that the Venezuelan government would much rather have their own people develop that and keep those dollars in-country. What is it that Venezuela is wanting to do with its natural resources in-country that the United States will be against? And when I say the United States, I'm really talking about the majority party.
The majority party? Well, actually, I think that what Venezuela wants to do is to be able to use the oil revenues to basically feed and house and give health care and services to its own people, and to change the dynamic that's been historically kind of rifted that country, which is the big division between rich and poor. And that historically the oil profits have benefited a very small elite in Venezuela, and the rest of the country, 70%, lives in dire poverty. So Chavez's government is using the oil profits to start to benefit the rest of the 70%. And he's made some inroads in that. But that is goes contrary to what the United States wants, which is to continue through the surge of the small elite to actually send a lot of those oil profits to the United States. And in fact, the elite and the people who oppose Chavez are people who spend most of their time in the United States. Their favorite city is Miami. And they buy American products, and they will travel abroad. In fact, the people, everybody that I met who was opposed to Chavez, I met at the airport, and they were on their way out of Venezuela. So the supporters of the opponents of Chavez, and who historically have been the people in control prior to the Chavez government, their interest is not investing back in their own country. Their interest is basically investing in the United States. So I think that it has to do with the same, I mean, the same model is going on here in Portland. We have a big Keep Portland Green movement, which has to do with keeping, besides keeping it green in terms of nature, but also keeping money, local money, like supporting local businesses.
Sure.
And so
sure.
That's a lot, I think, of what's going on. It's about that, and also that Venezuela will have control over how resources are extracted and where they go. And basically, using its own resources, and its primary resource is oil, but they've got other resources as well, other minerals, to keep them, to build up their own economy.
Okay.
So I have a question for you. What red state are you from?
Well, actually, I'm originally from Oregon, but I've been in Oklahoma for about the last 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm driving down the Eugene Corridor and very happy to not being pelted with rain.
Well, yeah, I know. I was very happy to come home and not have rain. Well, actually, one of the things, and this is what we were told by the Venezuelans, that they wanted us to come home and to let Americans know that Chavez is not, you know, the Latin American Hitler, and that he's really being demonized right now by Donald Rumsfeld and by a whole like disinformation campaign that's going on in the U.S. media. So, I mean, that's what I'm hoping today is that I can. Well, I'm certainly not just totally uncritical and think that Chavez is the answer to everything. I think that what he's doing is very positive for the Venezuelan people, and I think it's an experiment that really needs to continue and shouldn't be snuffed out by the United States.
No, I understand, and I know that, you know, we see in the national media, we see the sound bits, which I can see would play well back home for him as, you know, being able to kind of stand up as on their own as a sovereign nation. I guess I kind of wonder, you know, governance is a very sticky issue because you try to take complex issues and boil them down into 30-second sound bites, which we all know doesn't really work. It seems like he has done, to a certain degree, a good job of allowing what he doesn't want to be disseminated about him to be spread around in the U.S. markets, which is, you know, to be somewhat anti-West. And, you know, you can be anti-government without being anti-West.
Wait, can you back up? I'm not quite sure I follow what you're saying. You say he's done a good job of allowing that to being disseminated in the United States?
Well, and I'm saying that somewhat tongue-in-cheek. I mean, I understand that you want to let your people, if I'm Chavez, I want to let my people understand that, you know, I am not a puppet of whatever power, you know, wants to extract my resources. But at the same time, I think, you know, if he's wanting the West, and when I say the West, I mean the American people.
We're all in the West, actually. It's the North. This is a North-South divide. So.
No, I understand. Yeah. I'm speaking of the euphemism that generally when people in the world talk about the West, they're referring to the United States.
Right.
But I think he could do himself maybe some favors, and I know you're not going to be talking to him this afternoon, but...
I don't think so, yeah.
But, you know, any time that somebody gets up and rattles against our government, that there is a big segment of the country who, for pride, for whatever reason, rally around our government the same way that when he gets up and rattles against the U.S. that they rattle around or rally around him. I just think that global leaders need to become better salesmen for the national media, wherever it's being played. I think he could do, and the Venezuela's government, because, of, you know, I look at the media, always seems to like the underdog to a certain degree, he could really appreciate Chavez or whichever small government is really trying to achieve some autonomy, doing a good job of laying out what it is they want, because all we seem to get in the national media is, you know, the really hard-line, confrontational rhetoric that they glean out of his speeches, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, actually, I get a little uncomfortable with the escalation and with Chavez being called a Nazi, being called like Hitler.
I've never heard that quote.
Yeah, I mean, Rumsfeld, I saw it. I was on CNN. I watched it from Merida on Friday. So Rumsfeld was comparing Hitler and Chavez on Friday.
Oh, okay.
And was saying that that like Hitler, Chavez was elected by a majority of the people democratically, but then he, you know, has consolidated power and become a despot. So then after that, one of the people in Chavez's government called Bush the North American Hitler. And, you know, it's like, that I think is really counterproductive.
I
don't think that helps. On the other hand, I think that when Chavez stands up to the United States, rhetorically, it's very effective throughout, not just Venezuela, but throughout the world. And one of the very strong impressions I took back from this trip was how much the United States and George Bush in particular is reviled around the world. I mean, I was in Italy earlier this year, and it was the same thing. And throughout Europe, people really hate Bush. And there were these posters everywhere, speaking of Hitler, there were these posters everywhere throughout the forum of pictured George Bush with a Hitler mustache, and it said, Sassion.
Yeah.
And people, I mean, I have not seen this level of hatred towards another head of state. I'm not even, it's bigger than anything I ever saw towards Nixon or Johnson or even Reagan. It's really, I mean, this is, the people really fear George Bush around the world and see him as a really dangerous person. And I think that's something that we don't get a sense of here in the United States. We don't understand just how separated and isolated we are in the world. And it's.
Well, yeah, and understand that. I'm kind of a, I hope you're seeing some real open-mindedness in me, but, you know, I really am kind of an original, you know, constitutionalist. I would be considered a conservative, all of those kinds of things. I don't want my country, abusing the resources of other countries, and I don't want my country, to be cold and calloused. You know, but I do want, for the future, you know, I want the truth out there. I want us to all get along well, and I want what draws us together to be, you know, the care of our people and the care of our economy, which I think is a circular process. It takes care of itself and takes care of everybody involved. But I don't think that our government has been the great Satan out in the world. I think, unfortunately, there's been a lot happen over the last 20 years where there was a certain balance of power among superpowers that we don't have anymore. And I agree that we have done some things to bring a little bit of consternation on our head. But I think the idea of wanting to protect our way of life and wanting to support our future ability to, you know, to have freedom of religion and all of those kinds of things are going to be in conflict with where a lot of the world is. And I don't think that needs to be solved militarily, but, you know, that's why I'm so interested in your show and the things that you're saying, and haven't mean to take you off of topic, I do think that we are headed towards a much more global world, and not just, you know, islands in the sea, but we are all coming together because our markets are coming together, and we're all buying each other's products, and we're all benefiting from each other's labor.
Well, I want to just interject something, because, I mean, you talked about our way of life and protecting our way of life, and one of the things that you hear when you go out of this country to the South, as it's called now, whether in South America, Africa, or Asia, that people, that we here in this country consume so much, disproportionately to our population size, that we are depriving the rest of the world of basic human needs. And you really see that when you go into the barrios in Caracas. You see people living without... And one of the things that they say over and over again is drive your cars less. Use less electricity. I mean, I think that's where... I agree with you. I really don't want to see these things... I don't think they're solved militarily. I think you have a military...
Sure.
Adventure, and it just creates more problems. I think the first thing that Americans could do to start solving these problems is to start conserving and to start consuming less. And if we were really aware of how much we consume compared to the Venezuelans or to Nicaraguans and people in El Salvador and people who are even poorer, it would really give us pause. Venezuela, I guess, and I understand from people who've traveled throughout Latin America, it's a problem. Throughout a lot of Latin American countries, the plumbing is really bad. You cannot throw toilet paper down the toilet. So there's a little receptacle.
Yeah, I spent the summer in Brazil, down in a city called Campinas outside of Sao Paulo. And that was an interesting experience.
Yeah, and it's in Venezuela, it's true in Caracas. It's true everywhere, even in the most highly developed. I mean, like the Hilton Hotel in Caracas, which is a very nice 5-star hotel. Waste baskets right by the toilet. So when I came back to the States... And every time, you know, at that moment, it would make me think about, you know, this whole thing of, like, the kind of plumbing we take for granted here.
Sure.
It's just an example of the very difference in the lifestyle here and the lifestyle in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I just think those are things to consider, and that really, that I think we could solve a lot of problems if we cut our gas consumption drastically, if we started walking more, if we built our cities differently so they weren't so car-dependent, and if we just stopped producing and consuming all this stuff that we really don't need.
No, I'm in agreement on that. Well, I've got to conserve some cell phone for the way home.
Okay, well...
Hey, I appreciate all the information, and I appreciate your openness in talking with me.
And I really appreciate you calling and listening, so thanks for calling.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. And the number to call is 503-231-8187. It's about 29 minutes after... 8 o'clock. We're talking today about Venezuela, and it looks like probably we won't get to talk about that forest issue until later, and probably be better for me to actually try to get some of the people involved in this controversy, particularly the person who wrote the study. I'm real fascinated, this is kind of an aside, with what's going on with the whole issue about what happens to a forest after it burns, and whether we go in and we do salvage logging, or whether we basically let the forest heal itself, which is what this research paper as suggesting is a much better way to produce healthy forests. And it's a project that I'm actually starting to work on now, focusing on the biscuit burn. So you'll be hearing a lot more about that subject coming up in the next few weeks. But for the rest of the time, I think we'll be very happy to talk about Venezuela, which is also an endless subject, and we'll be hoping to talk more about it in the coming weeks as well. Anyway, we got another caller, so if you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. Hello, you're on the air.
Well, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine.
Well, it's good to hear your voice.
Well, thank you.
I kind of missed your show last week. Here's the deal. I think you touched on something that was very, very important, and it's about control of the region. As we can see, Latin America is starting to go more and more leftist, with Evo Morales in Bolivia and Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and now it appears that Mexico will probably have a leftist president, and the patterns I can see are probably very, very disturbing to the United States, who have been exploiting the regions for like God knows how long, right? The government of the United States of America is already starting to demonize Mr. Chavez. Pat Robertson called for his assassination. Rumsfeld has already said in a public speech that although Mr. Chavez was duly elected, he also said so was Hitler.
Right, yes, what we were just talking about.
Right. John Negroponte, who is obviously a terrorist, is like calling for Mr. Chavez's ouster. He's also made that same kind of statement, and I believe it was Mr. Negroponte who directed the right wing death squads out of Honduras, right?
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. And so all of these American terrorists are starting to point to Mr. Chavez as being a fascist. So I would suppose that would be very, very suspect. Right?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the things that I became actually more aware of when I was in Venezuela than I was before I left, of just how orchestrated this media campaign against Chavez, how it's escalating.
Uh-huh.
I guess there was an article in Parade magazine a couple weeks ago that was basically calling Chavez a despot and doing, you know, this whole thing of comparing him to Hitler has been going on for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And Rumsfeld's statement last week was just kind of like the latest in a whole build-up of anti-Chavez hysteria. And it does look like the United States government is trying to whip up a lot of anti-Chavez sentiment. I mean, what was interesting is most people in the United States don't know who Chavez is and can't tell Bolivia from Venezuela. And when there was an election recently in Chile, a friend of mine who should know said, didn't Venezuela elect a new president? So, you know, people, it's all one big country down there. People in the United States really don't understand Latin American geography, politics, history at all.
Mm-hmm.
So when they're ripping up hysteria against Chavez, it's ripping up hysteria among people who don't even know where Venezuela is.
That's a fact, right? But if you follow the way the fascists in the United States of America work, the process starts with demonization, and it ends in somebody getting whacked, and that seems to be a persistent pattern. If you would take a look at Salvador Allende in Chile, who was also duly elected, he ended up by getting whacked simply because Dr. Kissinger and Mr. Nixon decided that he was too big of a threat to Anaconda Kappa and Chiquita Banana.
But, you know, actually what's interesting is that Chavez has a very different relationship with the military than Allende did. And
right.
It was the military that rose up against Allende. The military's not going to rise up against Chavez.
There's no way that that's going to happen.
Yeah, what's that? What'd you say?
I said there's no way that's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, didn't they already expel some United States Navy guy?
They expelled an attaché to the mission.
Right.
And then the United States expelled a Venezuelan diplomat as well.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, I've got some more calls. I need to keep going.
Okay, great. It's good to have you back, Barbara.
Okay, thanks.
Have a good day.
Sure. And the number to call is 503-231-8187. We're talking today about the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela and a little bit about the World Social Forum. Maybe we'll talk more about that next week when some of my compañeros and compañeras are on to describe what we experienced there collectively and singly. And if you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. Just one quick thing. When I refer to the Bolivarian Revolution, it doesn't refer to Bolivia. It refers to Simón Bolívar, who is the hero of Latin America, particularly the hero of Venezuela, which was where he was born. And he was the one who basically led the liberation of Latin America from Spain back in the early 19th century. And every town, big and small, in Venezuela has a Bolivar Plaza, and the highest peak, mountain peak in Venezuela is Pico Bolivar, and on the top of Pico Bolivar is a bust of Simón Bolivar. And at the base of the mountain, or close to the base, where this teleférico, which is this cable car that goes up to the top of a peak very close to Pico Bolivar, there's a wonderful statue of the peasant farmer who climbed to the top of Pico Bolivar with the bust of Simón Bolivar, and he climbed up barefoot. So this is just kind of a sense of the lore and the cult, you know, the sort of the historic lore of Venezuela and the land of peasant farmers climbing mountains to place the bust of Simón Bolivar at the top of the 16,000-foot peak. Anyway, we've got some more time. We're going to join the conversation. Give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 24 minutes before 9 o'clock here on KBU. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I was wondering how... It seems like you said that if the United States consumes less, that it would help the rest of the world or help Venezuela. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, by the way, are you in heavy traffic?
Yeah, I'll have to hang up, but I got my question through anyway.
Okay, great, thanks.
All right, bye.
Okay, well, how can I elaborate on that? If you go to any place outside of the United States, Canada, Western Europe, or Japan, people live on way less than we do. And in many of these countries, particularly in South America, Africa, the Middle East, and parts of Asia, U.S. companies are there extracting resources, paying pitiful wages, if anything, to local people to do this resource extraction. And then the resources are brought back to this country to make things for us. And I think that we have to realize that we get things cheap because countries are paying, because the companies that make these things are paying workers in other countries next to nothing, either to make these products or to extract the resources that the products are made from. So these are all reasons why it's really important for United States citizens to become aware of how much we consume compared to the rest of the world, to understand the imbalance between that, and to, I think, take our responsibility to consume a whole lot less. And that's certainly something that's being said by many people in Venezuela and was said to all of us North Americans at the World Social Forum. So I hope that answers the question. And if you want to join the conversation, again, give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 22 minutes before 9 o'clock. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, old Bush. I just wanted to... I've been watching this Venezuela, this Chavez, since the first coup attempt on him. And really, this guy is really from the people, for the people, by the people. And it's really criminal what our society is allowing our government to do by just because they want their resources, because we don't want to pay expensive prices like England and Australia, and everybody's been paying for, God, what, 10, 15 years now? They've been paying $4 a gallon.
So, yeah, at least. Actually, when I was in Italy, it was about $6 a gallon.
Yeah, and I think it's 8 up in the northern parts in the Nordic and stuff. So, but, yeah, this is all a grab for resources, and we've got a country of poor people. And I just don't understand. I'm really just having a problem with this Pat Robertson and all these people coming out and condemning a man for helping the people. And I started realizing really the reality is that he's taking out of the pocketbooks of the rich of the United States and the rich of Venezuela. He's taking from their savings accounts that they're hoarding, that they should actually be back investing into our country and our economy and the Venezuelan economy. And he's just going into their accounts and just taking it from them, saying, listen, if you're not going to invest it, we'll invest it for you. And I think I commend him for doing that.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure that's exactly what's going on.
Well, that's an analogy.
Right. But it has more to do with basically the oil profits, which used to just go into their savings accounts, and now that he's spreading around the country. And, I mean, I visited a couple of the clinics that... that he's built in the barrios, and they're pretty impressive.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, and these missions, which are the government organizations, which go, and they have a mission of, you know, improving lives with, you know, in different areas. And so the mission for education is called Mission Robinson. And we were watching on television as this graduating class. It was a whole bunch of poor women who just had graduated from the literacy program, and they were all quite capable of reading.
Oh.
And that just like in Cuba after the revolution, that the big push in Venezuela is literacy and really increasing literacy amongst the poor people. Because one of the arguments that rich people make and the rich anti-Chavistas in Venezuela make is, oh, those poor people, they're just stupid.
Well, they are, because they were never given the time and the chance to make it, because they hoard their assets.
Right.
That's what we're getting down to, is we're dealing with social greed, and we're dealing with a sickness that only the coming of age will come and clean out. But really, it's going and becoming more, it's coming to a head around. And, you know, I was thinking, I produced television shows on public access television. I wanted to get a hold of Chavez to see if they'd actually fund me to do a show just strictly on Latin American news from Latin America, that they can actually, the Spanish and the Mexicans around town are feeling the same thing. They're being dumbed down through, you know, Telemundo and this other stuff. But there's only one station for all the Mexicans in the country to watch, and that's Spanish, and it's CNN. Telemundo and the other show that they have. So there's got to be a way to educate these people to help them understand. Because I talked to a couple Spanish guys that run a Mexican restaurant here in Oregon City, and what do you think about Chavez? Oh, he's military, and he's a facade. He's for the rich. And I looked at him, I said, wait a second, he's the one that just took, 100,000 acres back from the rich and gave it to the poor. Now so many people have an acre to live their life. And really, you've got the mouth of the right wing, Pat Robertson, telling you the truth. Because what did they say? They don't lie, do they? The religious people, they don't lie, because God says always tell the truth. So in truth, when he was speaking, he's telling the truth of what those people want to happen. And in truth, we're living under a fascist dictatorship, and we can put a mustache on Rumsfeld and Bush, and they're just going to walk around, you know, like it's Halloween. I mean, no one really gets it.
Well, I'm hoping, actually, that there's more people in this country go down to Venezuela. I mean, I think that there was a very large North American presence at the World Social Forum. And I do think that when we come back and we start talking about it, that it's helpful. And I think people, that we can educate more people about what's going on in Venezuela.
Right.
And that this kind of firsthand account, I'm not sure if you heard the guy who called a little while ago who was driving down the I-5 corridor. I mean, I think it's very helpful that someone like him is tuning into KBOO.
I think it's great.
And really wants to listen. And I'm sure, and he's going to have way more influence than I have, because he'll go back to Oklahoma and he'll talk to people there about what he heard on the show.
I hope so. And I hope it breeds like cancer, you know. But I was going to get your opinion. What do you think about getting a hold of Chavez and saying, listen, do you want to fund a show on public access? Would you like to do a show on public access television and to get out the truth? Do you think the government would come after me or anybody that would do
that? So, wait, you want Chavez to fund the show?
I want Chavez to fund me to do a show about Latin American news and have a Latin American guest that speaks Latin American that you get from nowhere, like CNN or NBC. You get the news from the people, from the country that we're talking about. And I'm wondering how long I would last before Bush would come down on me.
Yeah, well, I think you'd have a hard time getting funding from the Venezuelan government for doing that. I mean, I think that their resources are, you know, really dedicated.
I'm just talking like $600-$700 a month to help do a show, because I run it on a shoestring budget. I'm just wondering if they might be willing to, once they see the positive light that's coming out of a dark entity, I mean, once they see the beacon, do you think they might roll on that, and how long I would have before the government squashed me?
Well, I have a feeling you could probably do it for a long time here, unless you were, you know, incredibly effective, and then they might squash you. But I would be very skeptical that you could actually get funding from the Chavez government for that.
Well, I wanted to say goodbye to you, but I do have one last thing. Is it okay if I plug something? It's I'm producing a show that's for the people. It's a free service, and what it is, it's the Tuesday, the second Tuesday, and the fourth, or the second Wednesday, and the fourth Wednesday of every month. At 11 a.m. on Channel 11, there's a show called Nature's Ways. And this show, you can call the doctor, who is the doctor of the year last year, Dr. Chris Miletus. He ran the INM for 7 years. And this show, you can call and talk to two prestigious naturopaths of the Northwest for free to get advice and to get information and knowledge from these doctors for free for an hour. every Wednesday and Friday, the fourth Wednesday and Friday of the month.
Okay, thanks.
So it's for the free, for the people.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Power to the people.
And number to call is 503-231-8187. We've got about another 10 minutes left here of Locus Focus. We're talking today about my experiences recently in Venezuela, sort of a cursory look at an amazing country, and also what went on at the World Social Forum, which happened in Caracas 2 weeks ago. And you can give a call at 503-231-8187, and I would really like to hear from some women. It seems like this has been a pretty guy-heavy show, so give a call at 503-231-8187. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. Don't forget what Richard Nixon did to Salvador Allende, and don't forget what Ronald Reagan did to the Sandinistas. What I want to say, I watched on Channel 10 the other night the Nuremberg trial, and they kept showing Hermann Göring. He was evidently quite eloquent. And he said, the trial was the victor taking revenge on the defeated, and they wouldn't let Germany say the Allies had carpet-bombed German cities. They wouldn't allow any of that. So I kept thinking, who does Göring look like, Cheney or Rumsfeld? And I think it's Rumsfeld.
Okay. Okay, thanks for calling. And number to call is 503-231-8187. It's about 13 minutes before 9 o'clock on Locus Focus. We've got a little bit more time left. We're talking about the World Social Forum, which recently happened in Caracas, and my impressions from spending a couple weeks in Venezuela. And, again, I'd like to hear from some more women, so give a call, 503-231-8187. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if you saw the interview that Univision did with Evo Morales, where they kind of baited him for a while about his comments on President Bush, and then he walked out of the interview.
No, I didn't see that.
Oh, that, you were talking about how the media seems to be demonizing Chavez. That, my understanding of Spanish is basic, but they really tried to nail him with questions. Didn't you say this about George Bush? Didn't you say this? Didn't you say this? And after 10 or 15 minutes, he had enough, and he said, that's it. Thank you very much.
Well, good for him.
So.
Yeah, I mean, it's better to walk out than to be baited. Yeah, I guess kind of as an aside, because somebody was saying earlier about the negative comments that the negative things that Chavez would say about the United States. And in the speech that I heard him give, which was about an hour and a half long, which is very short for Chavez, but he said, smashed imperialism once. He made three references to Karl Marx, who he referred to as a German philosopher. He quoted Jesus. He quoted Nietzsche. He sang a song. He spoke very specifically about the projects, the missions that they're working on, and the process, and with the Constitution. He gave actually a very incredible history of 200 years of Venezuelan struggle, which I was an excellent history lesson. And then Cindy Sheehan was up on the same, on the stage with him, along with a bunch of other dignitaries. And he turned and he started talking about her, and he referred to her as Mrs. Hope, facing off Mr. Danger, who's what he calls Mr. Bush. And so, the reality of it was very, very, very little anti-American or even anti-Bush rhetoric. And it was mostly very constructive discussions of things that he'd like to see. And then at one point, he talked about what the power of the United States were to be a country that would give up war and to turn to peace, and how powerful that would be. And it was interesting, as Cindy Sheehan had not been responding that much when he was talking about different revolutionaries throughout Latin American history. But when he said that, she just burst into a spontaneous applause. And the other people, who were all people in the government, didn't respond nearly as big. It was almost like it took an American to understand the power that the United States has. Cindy Sheehan really got that, and the importance of turning this country towards peace.
Right.
So, and the connection between Cindy Sheehan and Chavez was very powerful. And the next day they gave a press conference, and Cindy Sheehan called Bush a terrorist.
Really?
Chavez gave her a big hug. We weren't sure at first when we were watching her on stage and she wasn't applauding. We were thinking, does she think that, all these ways that she's been called a communist dupe, because that's what she was, you know, called all last summer.
Yes.
Was she sitting there going, oh my God, I am one? But I think, I don't know why she didn't applaud, and it's something that I would love to talk to her about, but she's made some very strong statements, very pro-Venezuela. In fact, she said that the American people should know that the United States does not need to invade Venezuela to bring them freedom and democracy. The people of Venezuela already have freedom and democracy.
Right.
So.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
We got time for another phone call or two, so give a call at 503-231-8187. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. Let me take my radio off. I'm getting double signal.
Okay.
There's a video out called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised.
I saw that film. It came out last year.
Yeah. It gives a great history of what's going on down there. I have a resource if people want to pick one up for $5 plus shipping and handling. I can give you my email, and if anybody wants to get a copy of that. I think the one big issue is we need to talk about shades of gray. As great as things are happening down in Venezuela, a lot of people are still dying down there for the cause as well. And when we talk, we need to realize that a lot of these revolutions there's a lot of blood involved, unlike here in America.
Well, actually, you know, in Venezuela, there's not a lot of blood right now.
Well, I'm talking about Bolivia.
Well, no. Bolivia has had a lot of blood. Hopefully, now with Morales' government, the bloodshed will stop. Now, there there's a lot of blood in Venezuela, but since 1998, there has been very little bloodshed.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think in America, it's going to have to be from the ground up to get things changed here. And
that's what's inspiring about the Bolivian Revolution, because in Bolivia, it was really from the ground up.
Yes, I had a very good friend of mine from Seattle during the WTO who's been down there for 3 years, and she told me that people would be walking down the street and one of them get shot, right, boom, just fall right there, right next to her. So there's we don't get the smell of the revolution. We don't get to see things. We hear things in our head, and we still, what's the word? We filter it through our own environment, not through the environment that's down there. So when someone takes your water away and says it's going to cost you more money, it doesn't take long before you become thirsty. And so my whole issue is the emotional. We need our hearts to be pricked a little bit harder here in the West, you know, in America. So
By the way, one of the lessons that I learned there is we do not live in America. America is a very big place. We live in the United States.
That's what I meant.
Yeah.
United States, yeah. So my email is joe1drum1@yahoo.com. And
okay.
That's America 1. joe1drum1@yahoo.com. If anyone wants a copy of that.
Okay.
$5.
Well, it's a very good movie. Thanks so much for calling. Yeah, and I do highly recommend getting a hold of seeing The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, which is a film about the attempted coup in Venezuela in 2002, and we are having a discussion, my friends and I, when we were in Caracas, about just how coincidental this French film team happened to be in Caracas shooting a documentary about Chavez's government when this coup happened. But anyway, they did an amazing job. They were able to shoot both sides. They were inside with Chavez and his government while they were basically under siege, and they were also inside the halls where the coups were taking over, and it was an amazing contrast, an excellent, excellent film. Well, we got another minute or two and time for at least one more call, so hello, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, maybe someone should send that film to the Jon Stewart show, because he dissed Cindy Sheehan pretty soundly, roundly on his show this past, and I don't know when it was, I watched TiVo'd versions, but in the last few days. And
what did he diss her for?
For supporting Chavez publicly and speaking out against, you know, the government here. They showed an out-of-context clip, now I realize, of her talking after listening to all of the things you said she said. I was like, boy, they didn't show any of that, which would have been really amazing. And, you know, your discussion of it is really excellent. But, you know, they just showed a little clip of her making a kind of a heartfelt speech about him fighting imperialism and an imperialist regime and, you know, saying good for you, and you know, Jon Stewart just kind of did one of his eyes open, arms thrown out, you know, like, what, you know, what's this all about? And I just think, you know.
Yeah, well, he certainly needs to be educated about a number of things.
Mm-hmm.
As do, I mean, many people who are supposedly liberals, who I don't think, people just don't understand what's going on in Venezuela.
That's really
so
true.
That's what we need to be talking about.
And I've noticed that Negroponte, every time he gets up in front of a committee or something like that, anytime I see him on C-SPAN or anywhere else, and Rumsfeld does this too, and some others, they just like to take a shot, you know, at Chavez out of nowhere. It's like the topic will be something completely different, and all of a sudden they'll just pick Chavez out and just for a little, you know, free PR bite, and they'll just say something kind of nasty about him.
But being down there, now I understand why they're so scared of him.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
And meeting people from Bolivia in particular. So I think there's a very strong movement in Latin America. I'm actually hopeful. I think it's too big for them to be able to take out. Plus, we have to remember the United States military barely exists anymore.
Yes, that's true, and so that gives me some hope, too,
yeah.
I guess.
Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Well, thanks for calling, and we've got to get out of here, but I want to let you know that coming up at 9 o'clock, it's Movie Talk with reviews of the latest movies from Ed, DK, and Don. At 9:30, Per Fargering will be in to talk about Empire and its limits. At 10 on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller speaks with Lauren Regan from the Eugene-based Civil Liberties Defense Center about the recent federal indictments against animal rights and environmental activists. Then activist, author, and ethnic studies professor Ward Churchill joins the show to place these events in historical context. Jim Flynn, a former longtime editor of Earth First Journal, will also provide information about activist security culture. And at 11 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! Next week, I'm hoping to be back with Patrick Engstrom-Poor and some other folks to talk a little more in depth about what happened when we were in Venezuela last week and the week before, and about the World Social Forum. And in 2 weeks, it'll be another Whole Communities Radio Project special, and we'll be talking about the Equity Atlas that's being produced by Coalition for a Liberal Future. Jim Levy from the Oregon Portland Audubon Society and Jill Fuglister from Coalition for a Liberal Future will be on to talk about that. So stay tuned for all that and wonderful more stuff on KBOO. I'm really glad to be back. We're going to go out with some music by Teo Hurtado. And his Guianese guitar and a little bit of music from Venezuela.
It's 9 a.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up is Movie Talk. At 9:30, Per Fagerin will be in to talk about Empire and its limits. At 10 on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller speaks with Lauren Regan from the Eugene-based Civil Liberties Defense Center about the recent federal indictments against animal rights and environmental activists. Then, activist, author, and ethnic studies professor Ward Churchill joins the show to place these events in a historical context. Jim Flynn, a former longtime editor of the Earth First Journal, will also provide information about activist security culture. And at 11, it's Democracy Now!
Greetings, this is Contessa de la Luna. The Cable Board of Directors will meet this Friday, that's right, this Friday. Support and be an active member listener by attending the Cable Board of Directors meeting this Friday evening at 6 p.m., 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, one half block south of Burnside, Darling. Kiss, kiss.
Saturday, February the 11th, the PCC African Film Festival will host a special symposium and community conversation on the African legacy in Mexico. The program will offer the community an opportunity to learn more about the history and cultural influences of the Africans in Mexico. At 10 a.m., the program will start off with a trilogy presented by Mexican film director Rafael Robayar Corona. The trilogy will include his films The Forgotten Root, From Flora to Coahuila, and his work in progress, Incursion into the Hills. In the afternoon, the director and other experts in the fields will speak on the Afro-Mexican identity, followed by a community conversation with local activists and audience members. Both events will be held in the new Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Auditorium Room 104, at the Cascade Campus on 705 North Killingsworth Street. This KBOO co-sponsored event will be free to the public. For more information, go to www.africanfilmfestival.org or call 503-244-6111, extension 3630.